Welcome to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zierer.
And I'm Daisy Alioto, and I'm very relieved that Francis is back.
I'm back. It was, you know, it's been the long 2 weeks without me. I know. But
well, long for me, but not for you. You were chilling in Mexico.
I was chilling in Mexico, work offsite. I'd never been to Mexico before.
Interesting.
Yeah. I still haven't really been to Mexico because it was,
I would say, yeah.
We were like, well,
maybe we can
thing.
Do a little Tasteland, Mexico City, John.
That would be fun. That would be fun.
I have an open invitation from one of our freelancers that lives in Mexico City. I'm like,
to stay at their house.
Yeah. I was like, are you sure? That's like, and she was like, yeah, whenever.
You should do it. This is how the chorizo is made, people.
Yeah.
Anyways, okay. Speaking of chorizo, who are we talking to today?
We're talking to Matt Rodbard. He's a writer, editor, and author of food and culture books with more than 2 decades of experience working in television, magazines, book publishing, and online media. He has a podcast called Taste.
This is Taste.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He has taste, but he doesn't have land. So,
well, neither do we.
And neither We've do we. No, both. We have millennial real estate all the time, though.
Good callback. I'm a fan of his work. I'm a fan of his podcast. We've had his often co-host, co-podcaster, Eliza Barbanel on the pod before.
Yeah, we did.
He's also the founding editor of Cakesian. Taste, the publication.
Yeah.
I should say that, of which this is Taste is a part. Anyways, I was at the Webby's last night.
You were at the Webby's last night, and you took a selfie with the Rizzler.
I did. Well, it wasn't a selfie. Our mutual friend, Ari, did take the photo. I have to say, this picture of me with the Rizzler is...
You look much older than him.
Well, it's because I'm about 21 years older than him, give or take a couple of years. Okay, so he was there because he won an award with this video that our mutual friend, Ari, from AIR, my old employer, my old boss, they made a video with him. They won. They had a whole table. I was not sitting with him. I was sitting.
I didn't
some of the
win,
table.
But I would like to say for the record, I did not pay to enter.
No, which is the only way you can win. You have to pay to enter.
Yeah.
Which is like any award show. Like, you know, I think the Oscars you don't, but the Grammys, the Emmys, I know you do. Anyways, the Rizzler, it was 10 p.m. It was his bedtime, I imagine. Far be it from me to say, I suppose. But I was really impressed by his composure, his willingness to take the picture. Yeah, shout out to that guy.
Five booms for the Rizzler's maturity.
Booms for the Rizzler. You know, he is properly rated, perhaps underrated.
What beverage was he having?
I don't know. I was.
What beverage were you having?
I had some white wine. Anyways,
okay. Well, I'm assuming the Rizzler did not have white wine.
The Rizzler did not have. The Rizzler had no.
I just hope they did something special for him.
Okay, I was just talking about the Webbies. I was at the Webbies last night, not as a winner, but as press. Come on, Daisy. I didn't even apply. I'm actually not a loser because I did not submit Creator Spotlight or Tasteland to be a Webby.
What?
So I was just there as press, which is great. But I wanted to bring up some food Webbies, just briefly.
Okay.
So there's a number of, you know, food related categories. We're not going to go over all of them, but I was there in the capacity of writing about, they've got this new creator category, right? Like the Webbies have always kind of had creator awards, but now they've got a specific one. But anyways, this was the one that was most interesting to me. The most viral award in the creator category is, which is the Webby's one, which is the formal voting body, right? And then there's the People's Voice, which is the one where anyone can vote. But most viral took the formal award, not the People's Voice, for sometimes you need to eat an entire cucumber.
Most important question, are we talking English cucumber? Or are we talking like some kind of fancy varietal?
Oh,
that
it was,
is,
it, did you not see these videos?
I did see these videos.
You did? Yeah, actually. So it must be English.
I think it's an English standard.
Oh, so this is the TikTok guy that makes the cucumber salads and shakes
them
in the
container?
Yes,
it's that guy. And he's in a lake. Okay,
he's cool.
We'll do one more though before we move on from this. The creator winner for the food and drink category specifically, the Webby, the formal Webby, went to the Babish Culinary Universe.
Okay.
And the People's Voice went to Joshua Weissman.
Weissman, he's the biggest food creator on YouTube, like hands down. And he just split up his universe. He's doing his around the globe stuff, and then he's back to his traditional Weissman in the kitchen, slapping his ass, like, you know, flexing his muscles. And I like that pivot for him, that he's back in the kitchen, not just doing like the top 10 chicken sandwiches around the world kind of stuff, which is no shade. I like that stuff too. Mm-hmm. What did you think, Francis, about these guys, Babbage and Weissman?
Yeah, I think, I mean, what's most interesting to me is like the definition of creator. And I would say both of these guys are creators, but they're so matured as a type of creator, right? Like when this is like one of my ongoing bits on Creator Spotlight, my the newsletter and podcast is like, what does it mean to be a creator?
He has a lot of bits.
I have a lot of bits. But I have two definitions. One is more broad, which would fit really anybody, fit all of us, fit anybody on any category of these webbies, right? Is somebody contributing to the corpus of the internet. But my more specific one, especially as it relates to my usual work, is like somebody creating content for distribution online to an audience beyond their immediate friends and family who is trying in some ways to monetize it. But another thing that I've kind of removed and added from my definition at various times is this idea of independence, right? And I think Babish is part of this network, like of maybe talent. They're both part of talent management networks, but I think they're both still relatively independent. But it's like when the Grammys have Best New Artist and they've been around for 10 years, right? Like,
yeah, it's like her gets that award every year. Like, I feel her has been the Best New Artist for like the past 10 years. Like, it's new every year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about, so I listened to your recent episode with Robert Sietsema, one of my favorite food critics, who, as we all know, we've talked about this actually multiple times on the podcast, was laid off from Eater around 6 months or so ago. And now he has a newsletter on Substack.
And now I don't read Eater. I couldn't tell you the last time I went.
I stopped reading after that. I actually still check it like once a week, but I used to check it every morning. I'm much less informed on,
you know, actually food is one of the categories that I just don't know if we're going to be doing a lot of linking from Clone. You know, it's like how much culture of the tech and culture do we want to be doing? But maybe I should add Eater to the blog roll.
You should add Taste to your Clone. And by the way, as a sidebar, congratulations. Super fly Thank design. You. I think I was a visitor 11,750. What an endorphin rush to have that at the top of your page every day, must say.
Thank you.
It's terrific. I love that. I love what you're doing there.
Thank you so much. Yeah, the really response cool. has been really positive.
Very cool. Sorry, I had to say that.
No, I think, well,
we okay. were going to talk about Clone a little
we
bit.
We were going to anyway. Talk about Clone at some point. I do want to, you know, by using the Robert Sietsema transition, though, I do still want to talk about that. So one thing that I found really interesting is right around the time he was laid off and all these, a few other of his colleagues were laid off from Eater, Mike Chow of Food Baby New York, he had a listicle, speaking of, you know, 10 best chicken sandwiches, a listicle of like, I think it was like the 24 best slices of cake in New York City that was published in Eater. And it was his first byline in Eater, though he'd been used as a source for longer features twice. And I found that to be really interesting and not really a coincidence, right? That like right when a bunch of these much more longer tenured writers were laid off, Mike Chow,
the
Instagram guy.
Are you sensing a sea change shift? I have a thought on that strategy, but I get a sense, Francis, from the wind up that this is not the Eater. This is not like the Lockhart Steel Eater that you loved before.
Well, we sort of talked about it in the context of like Lindy Man and Cold Healing and GQ.
Nick Cattucci then bringing them
which is
in
like
all around the same
instead
time.
Of the, I mean, Gawker is a prime example and. That legacy carried through Deadspin and now Defector, you take these writers, you give them a platform and they build their platform through their affiliation with the publication. Now the strategy is take people that already have a platform and, you know, bring them onto the publication in hopes that they will bring their audience with them, which is, I think it's a short-term versus a long-term game.
Agree fully. I think it's absolutely an audience development strategy from Eater. And I'll just say my take on Eater. I think they're doing terrific journalism, like Petita Muck-Lental, like Rebecca Marks at Eater National. I think it's worth reading. I think what Jaya Saxena is writing is great. I'm not trying to stand for Eater. These are just longtime colleagues. Mm-hmm. So I just have to say, I read it, I love Jaya. And I think it's really, really important work. And we can talk about the death of the website, of the webpage, of the single page, of the article text on the screen, because I have a lot of thoughts. But I think it's an audience development play to bring in creators to do text on page articles and hoping that there's a halo effect for traffic from Food Baby or whoever it may be writing these listicles. They got to do what they got to do to develop audience, right? I didn't read that piece. I'm not sure if it was good or bad. Tend to probably not read a Food Baby byline in Eater, at least, so I'm not drawn to it by the byline. But I think that they're just trying to get any, by any means possible, get people to read eater.com and click on that.
No,
page.
I totally agree. And I mean, look, yeah. I'll engage with the Food Baby Instagram post. It's no shade to him, and it's no shade to, like, you know, what you have to do to survive. But it is more to me like a bummer in that I specifically went to Eater to read Robert's work, right? So now I go there, but much less. But one thing Robert said on that episode you did with him is that the food critic is being supplanted by social media, which not necessarily a new thing, but you guys talked about how that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, Robert is somebody who I think has a really great take on everything. I don't think he's bitter. I think that he knew that this day would come for him. And he doesn't want to be the grumpy old guy talking about, you know, shading the creators who are out there doing what they will, which could be giving really poor, lukewarm takes about restaurants. Some of it's paid and completely PR driven, and some of it is very thoughtful, and it is maybe supplanting or at least complimenting the food critic. And I think with Robert, it's like, go to his Substack and pay $30 a year and get Robert. Get Robert's take on the city. He's publishing multiple Substacks a week. It's good stuff. And he's doing the work, which when it comes to food writing, you really can't growth hack this thing. Like if it's literally like local journalism covering a city or covering a state, you can't growth hack it. You have to literally go in, put your butt in the seat, order the food, try it out. Like that's why it's very, very, there's a low margin with food media because of the time it takes to do the work and the cost it takes to do the work. So I think he has a really good, I love that. Thank you for listening to the episode. I think it was really important that he got it out there that he's just, you know, still being Robert and riding his bicycle around, going to all the great restaurants that we have never heard of.
The Bill Cunningham of food media.
Oh my gosh. He is tireless. And the Robert Seitzema documentary will happen. I'm sure there's a young entrepreneurial filmmaker who will be linking with him. And, you know, I thought the Jonathan Gold documentary was very like up and down. It was fine. It was a pretty good documentary. But I think Robert's is a totally different ballgame. And I hope somebody actually does that because I think it would be a terrific piece.
Well, he said he's writing a memoir, right?
He's writing a memoir like slowly. And I think I've been able to acquire a bunch of early editions or I guess editions of Down the Hatch, his original, you know, copy and paste zine that he did at his job after hours. He stole the copy ink from his job. And he's such an original voice out there. And we got to treasure Robert for his work.
Are they making a Keith McNally movie?
Ooh. You guys,
somebody has to have.
I ordered the book the other day. I have not read it yet.
I haven't read it yet either. Well, I wasn't Balthazar the other day.
I flexed. I got the McGalley.
I got the McGalley.
What a flex. And I read it. And I also read The Great and Carter back to back. I was doing, I didn't read.
Perfect double feature.
I didn't read The Lorne. The Lorne is just too much. And, you know, hagiography perhaps. But I think they're both very different. I thought McNally's he's so literary. Mm-hmm. The man loves books, and it's tremendous to see him flexing, especially in the early sections about the books he read as a kid, and you know his relationships with really the highest level of London, the world of plays and like academia. He was in those circles at a young age. Really cool book.
One more thing on the food creator aspect I want to talk
about
is I've been noticing, this might just be my own personal feed and, you know, my own algorithmic curation over the past few years, but I feel like I've been starting to notice more critical people making these Instagram reels, right? Like as perhaps, you know, your eaters lay off their last staff food critic, Specifically people like Rob Martinez in New York City. I think he's really good. James Dimitri in London. This guy, Johnny Novo in New York City, who just does rotisserie chicken reviews. These are all people who I think aren't doing purely positive promotional, basically freelance marketing for restaurants. Not that it's not that too, but there's like, they're going to say the chicken was dry. This tea sucked, you know, this kind of thing. And I feel like I wasn't seeing that as much a couple of years ago. Maybe this is some kind of recency bias, but I do think that there is more and more thriving, actually critical engagement with some of these people.
France, I love the mention of Rob Martinez. He's been on our show and I really respect his work. And I think you're absolutely right. And I think that's a matter of more folks moving on to Reels and TikTok for their food knowledge. And really, the audience is becoming more discerning. And so the stretchy cheese polls from the sisters is for a certain audience. But I think if you want to look at food critically, there's people who are just migrating over to this social video platform that we all love. And you're right, they're talking shit sometimes. And it's important to see it. I think it's like very powerful to have somebody on mic and on camera say, I don't like this food because... It definitely has more power than a written article and a mm-hmm. takedown. And I think you're seeing it also in traditional food media. So you're seeing Mackenzie out in San Francisco, the San Francisco Chronicle critic is doing video reviews essentially or getting on camera. I think you're going to see the New York Times critics and possibly the New Critic do more video reviewing. So I think there's definitely, you're seeing it in more traditional spaces as well. I think the LA Times has done it as well. Mackenzie Chung Fagan, sorry, I couldn't remember her full name. She's such a terrific critic out in San Francisco. I just think it's like they're finding the audience where they are. And I think the people who have been really married to reading text on the page are just not doing it anymore. Mm-hmm. I feel this is a little bit of a theme I want to talk about as somebody who edits and really puts a lot of work. Eliza Barbanal, my co-editor here at Taste, we commit a lot of time like you folks do at Dirt to working in rounds. We're in the Word docs. We're doing the line edits, but it's frustrating as fuck, man. It's frustrating right now. I'm just being honest, being candid.
You mean like, because the amount of attention share going towards short form video versus text.
Yeah, and podcasts too. Mm-hmm. And just with AI, becoming the go-to and just, you just have to recognize this rapid sea change is affecting. And it is traffic. And I say it to anyone in our world here, we don't have page view KPIs on our business plan and on our editorial plan. We publish the work we think is important, and we hope the audience will find it. We did this big story about Trader Joe's last year that by Adam Reiner is a terrific piece, and that got a million page views, literally. So wow. We have breakouts once in a while, but week to week with our slate of stories, we're struggling to get people to read it. And this is like my mom. Like, my mom's not reading Taste right now. And I'm like, it's like my mom. And it's not because my mom doesn't want to read Taste. It's that she's on social video. She's listening to these podcasts.
My mom reads Dirt. She was the
hell
first
yeah.
person to text me about my Polo Bar poem in black.
Your mom is awesome. I love that your mom is reading Dirt, as she should. And my mom, less awesome, at least in terms of reading Taste. Maybe my mom is reading Dirt, frankly. That might be
her. Yeah, we got her. Well, I still think about the illustration on TJ's story about horses.
Oh, that's a classic.
Oh, great.
That was so good. Yeah. I think I was even like, was it a GIF?
It was. We did some animation with that.
The more there's slop there is, we always sort of like, I mean, we've never like done all stock photos, but a lot of our artwork, unless it's a special package, is a bit of an afterthought. It's like, oh God, somebody spin up something in Canva.
Yeah.
And honestly, like the worse everything online starts to look, the more I've wanted to double down and invest in custom illustration. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe this is a bit of a controversial take. You guys don't have to co-sign, but as a woman, I will say I was at Meriwether Coffee the other day, meeting somebody on Hudson Street. There was a line, obviously. And there were two women in a row who had like clearly had work done. They had basically the same nose, the same face, TikTok face. And then there was a woman standing behind them who had more of a like distinctive profile. And I realized that like my eyes could not rest on the first two women. It's like my eyes just like slid past them. I couldn't like really even like look at them. Like not because they weren't attractive to look at. They were beautiful women, but like there was nothing to hang my gaze on. But then the third woman, I was sort of like kind of staring at her because I was like, she looks distinct. And I feel the same way about the internet right now. Like, obviously, do whatever you want with your face, your body, your choice. But I think like there always is a pendulum swing back to the things that actually are distinctive and attract our gaze. And like the more sameness there is, the more the things that just don't look like everything else stand out. Mm-hmm. And the problem is like you have to have enough people drawn to that and willing to pay for it to support it. But I do think it's possible to move people over and take them from being consumers of slop to consumers of tasteful, bespoke content. It's just figuring out what is the pathway that you build from one to the other. And, you know, how do you take somebody who grew up not paying for content and turn them into somebody who proudly pays for content? Or if not content, something else in the world of your publication, maybe it's not content.
Advertising revenue.
Yeah.
I co-sign on that big time. And I think having big art is important to us at Taste. And Ellie Skerzat, I think, did that ILO. And we definitely have a visual identity that people come back for, and deviating from the mean and having not Canva or AI generated art or even like the standard food photography. I think we at Taste have bucked doing too much art, like food photography driven lead imagery on our homepage and on the social crops that we do for all the platforms. I think we just need to have, I mean, ILO doesn't always play well with SEO, but SEO is dead. So good riddance. And it just is important to have a strong visual identity that I think Green Carter writes about in his memoir. Back to that is like, you know, big art and having a real point of view with art direction as he does at Airmail now is so key to being that place that, you know, maybe you don't have a million UVs, but if we have a really high quality 200K UVs and a really big newsletter following, you got to invest in that stuff. And we pay our illustrators. And I just firmly believe that a visual identity is how you get people in.
This is how I think about like laying out the newsletter, laying out Career Spotlight every week is like, I do the test of like scroll up and down really quick. And if it all kind of looked the same, then we fucked up and we need to like make some custom graphic or find the right screenshot or like some Instagram post from, you know, the person we're interviewing, whatever. But I think it's easy for people to forget that a newsletter is a visual medium. I think even before it's a written medium, you know, which is a line I got from Ernie Smith, who writes the newsletter Tedium that he's been doing for like a decade, but he got his start as like a newspaper layout guy like 20 years ago. And ever since he told me that, it's like, you know, it's the details of the headings, even whatever. But like, you have to think about it in terms of visual texture. The information doesn't matter if it's not attractive enough for people to stick around and consume it.
Yeah. That's why I think so many magazine editors keep their jobs because, and I mean like the ones from the 90s and the early 2000s, mm-hmm. I think that when you think visually and you think of the story as a full package, that's why Janice Min has a great job. That's why Graydon Carter is still working. Tina Brown is still doing her, I mean, she's doing a Substack, but I think she was on a podcast recently talking about she just needs Substack to come to her and meet her somewhere with the visual identity of Substack. I think it really frustrates her.
Good luck, paraphrasing. Tina.
Yeah.
That was on the Mixed Signals.
Yeah. Great. We got Mixed Signals Hive here.
Yeah.
It's a terrific podcast. They've really like jumped ahead of a lot of media podcasts, with a great mix of stories. But I think that it's like, there's like consumers that haven't changed like full stop. They want every element to be premium and cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think Dirt, I mean, I really, when you say you think do Canva, I like Dirt has a visual identity to me. I mean, it's fully internet online first, obviously, but you guys are clever and you have a lot of humor with your lead illos and with, you know, even if it's a screenshot and like, you have to do it that way. You just can't just throw up. That's why I literally throw up. I am going to throw up when I think about some of the way this art is literally thrown up, like the patterned background with the bad Zillow art. Like, that's fucking so bad. I can't believe that still works on the internet.
Yeah, I do think we have a distinct visual identity, and I like to think it's not just that, like, Daisy touched it at some point. And I do, like, when I was working together with Walden, we would often align on the same idea, like when he wrote about why the price of eggs is such a site for political paranoia and projection. We were both like, this needs an illustration. I think we texted each other at the same time, like, broken egg, you know? So, and that's what we ended up doing. But I, like, Beehive recently just changed the way that you do your design build. Like, all of the capabilities are the same, but they changed it a little bit. And in the course of migrating our newsletter, some of our presets got changed. And the one that I noticed was actually the angle of the corner on our quotes, on our block quotes. Mm-hmm. And it was like a breakthrough moment for me, because I've never been so, I am definitely aesthetically inclined. I don't always focus on details like kerning or, you know, the angle of the corner. But I was like, I've looked at this every day for the last 2 years. And basically, I was like, something is wrong. And I, like, screenshot both of the corners and I'm comparing them and I'm showing Kat. I'm like, do you see this? So we sent it to them and they regressed us to the old system for a little bit so we could write down all of our presets, and then they migrated us. And now it's working beautifully. And I think it's a great example of, like, the relationship that you want with your platform provider. But it's so funny that like, it's the angle of the corners, you know? And, you know, it plays into everything. We just published a piece in Prune by Sam Wells, and Sam wrote to me and said, I'm not a writer. I haven't published before. I'm a woodworker, but I have this idea on to write about the legacy of Thomas Moser and his relationship to Shaker Design and scale. And, you know, what is Shaker Design? All corners, all joinery. And so I think, like, all of these things that don't seem related and seem like they must fall in the binary between offline and online aesthetics, it's all part of the same conversation that we're having with our readers about, like, the world that we want to build for them and the world that we all, like, ultimately want to inhabit.
So we were talking a little bit before this about the relationship between a written product and an audio product. Mm-hmm. Matt, what is the relationship between Taste as a publication and This Is Taste as a podcast? And has that changed over the last, you know, almost a decade?
Really great question. And we are about a decade old, and we didn't have a podcast when we launched in 2017. We soon launched one in 18. And it was a little bit of a more, it was a more minimal show. We did once a week. We were really focused on doing 4 to 5 features a week at that point. We certainly have flipped it in the past 2 years. And that's simply because we are seeing tremendous interest engagement from our podcast. And for us, you know, here at Penguin Random House, which is the parent company of Taste, Crown Publishing Group, we really want engagement with what we're writing. You know, we aren't about just throwing shit up. And I really wanted to come to where the audience was at. And looking at, you know, just the Spotify numbers, and Apple is in a black box, as you know, so we don't know our Apple audience at all. But looking at Spotify, which is about, you know, 15% of our audience, you know, our completion rate is really great. Like, we have 50%, 60% go into the last quarter of the pod. And that all is to say, like, we just want people to engage with what we're doing here at Taste, which is covering the culture of food, frankly. And we just felt like we needed to scale back our features. So now we're doing one big feature a week, plus 2 newsletters. And every other week, we're publishing a terrific cooking column from Zola Gregory. And with the added time resources away from the features, we're in the pod world, and we're publishing 3 to 4 podcasts a week, which is
insane.
It's a high metabolism pod, but it is insane. And Clayton, our terrific lead producer, is to credit to, like, keep up with the pace of the editing. And I I really commend Clayton for just keeping up with it. And for us, I think the Always On Pod is where we need to be right now. We have tremendous download traffic, and we have a lot of partnerships built around our audience. But really for us, it's mostly we want to commit full episodes to people who may be getting the C segment or D segment or not even booked on other shows in our cohort. We just want to give them the space. So we give our audience the choice. Do you want to do 4 hours with This Is Taste a week, or do you want to dip in and do one? We find a lot of listeners are somewhere in between and doing a couple episodes a week. But it was just it's kind of our editorial strategy to like think about each episode as a real portrait of the guest. And then we have other segments. You, Eliza, and I like to catch up for our three things segment. We'll have a lot of journalists on, and we just launched
just talking about food.
Yeah. We got this YouTube show that has been really fun, and we're trying to really, we don't do a lot of like full episodes on YouTube. We do mostly social clips, but we wanted our only like full episode show to be talking about the industry, talking about work, like what you do on your show, on your podcast. You talk about a lot of the work in the industry, and we wanted to do that, but featuring writers we love. So
it's been about money. And I think people like that. I met somebody recently in the publishing industry, and they were like, "Can I ask you a rude question?" And I was like, "Yeah." And they just wanted to talk about money in a real way. Like, basically, how do you make this work? And that was a lot of our conversation with Sarah Leonard recently of Lux Magazine.
Yeah.
You know, we're doing an award together for the best hybrid criticism personal essay about work. And I'm actually really hoping we'll get some strong submissions about the food industry, because I think that those critiques are really fun to read. Yeah, I think there is an appetite for real conversations about how the sausage gets made. This is the second time using a version of that phrase
on into it
podcast, on this very day. But what are like, okay, obviously money, distribution, dwindling number of places to do text criticism, all of these things are important topics of conversation ongoing. But what are some other themes that you're tracking, both across various episodes of the podcast or sort of like threads that are currently running between the features,
yeah,
you know, that you're selecting and the podcasts and
great question
and the topics?
Well, money definitely is at the center of our podcast, and we talk about money a lot, and this plays out in many different forms. We have a lot of chefs and operators of various renown, you know, the biggest, you know, Jamie Oliver was just talking about money recently, and we have, you know, chefs who just operate one restaurant in New York, and we're always talking about money because right now the restaurant industry is at a great inflection point, to use a cliche, but it really is, where the diners, really the ethic of the diner and the real behavior of the diner is changing, where these prices that we see on restaurant menus, not just in New York or LA, but in all cities, are eye-popping, eye-watering.
Irrational hospitality, as we would say.
Irrational hospitality.
Colin Nagy on the pod.
I love Colin. I love Witty. That is a great, 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 great subject.
Well, you know, I feel like every culture, every podcast is about money, except for podcasts that are supposed to be about money, and they just end up being about restaurants. You know, like,
yeah. I mean, we talk about restaurant culture because it's on all the great podcasts. I mean, how many times does How Long Gone talk about restaurants? It's literally every 40 seconds.
The most famous restaurant podcast there is.
It really is, and I've had both Jason and Chris on the show, and Jason's written for Taste, and they have really sharp minds about the industry and trend. But we talk about money because the diners are seeing these eye-watering prices, and they're saying, "Are we getting ripped off? Is this just..." But then we talked to like Camilla Marcus, who ran Westbourne in New York for years, just really progressive thought leader in the industry. And she worked at Roar, which was an alliance for industry workers. And, you know, we talked about payroll tax and how payroll tax, that 30% tax that's added to every dollar that you spend on labor, is a flat tax that is being taxed for anybody in New York, whether you run a watch store with two employees or a restaurant with 77 employees. And the fact that the watch store has to pay the same tax rate for their employees versus the restaurants. And, you know, Camille had a very simple solution. It's instead of 30%, let's make it 10%. And the money that's saved from the 20% for payroll tax, allow the restaurant to invest that back into their employees, into the payroll. So we talk and for benefits and for paid time off and all the things we talk about. So we talk about that a lot on the show. We also talk a little bit about the way that restaurants are cool and not cool, and like the way neighborhoods are cool and not cool, and to use broad strokes. But I love that we can talk about the changing tastes of diners in like cities like New York and LA, and how that will trickle down effectively to the rest of the country eventually. So we talk about how QSR restaurants may be dead right now, but you know, restaurants that are special occasion restaurants, people are flocking there for a lot of reasons, you know, cultural capital, or just people are spending less and spending better. Mm-hmm. So these are themes where restaurants are always at the center of what we're talking about, it seems.
I don't know if this is just a personal trend in my life, but in the same way that I've stopped, when I say I've stopped, you know, reading Eater, that's also more of a proxy for like I've stopped trying to stay up to date on like, oh, what are all the new restaurants opening in New York, right? I'm definitely somebody among my friends where it's like, oh, Francis, I'm going out in this neighborhood tonight, like where should I go? And here's five ideas, but I'm kind of having less of those ideas. I'm becoming more interested in like, I just want to go, I live in Ridgewood, I just want to go to like the few local restaurants that I know I can get into, and I don't have to make a reservation, and I don't have to think 2 weeks in advance, I want to go out to dinner here, which for the past couple of years, I was more like, okay, I'm going to, you know, I want to eat at Bonnie's. So 3 weeks before the day I'm going to go, I'm going to set an alarm at 10 a.m. and I'm going to get that reservation.
Yeah.
But I love going out to eat, and we'll go every weekend pretty much or more. But I'm kind of burnt out on like, how much there is, but that might just be a personal.
Yeah, I'm not trying to have a cool restaurant experience right now.
You mean I'm cool? Not. Like you're not trying to go to like the new Dame or the, you know, the et cetera.
Corvette.
Exactly. A great restaurant I've heard. I'm not craving to go not there myself.
Not even on my radar. You know, I think the last restaurant that I saw recommended by somebody and went because I saw it be recommended was, Jason Diamond recommended Daphne's.
Yeah.
And I went and had a nice time. But Francis and I have been talking about is sort of like reversion to the classics. And is it because I'm getting older, I'm growing up, I'm in search, like novelty doesn't mean as much to me. I'd rather have consistency. I don't have real tolerance for playing the reservation game or, God forbid, waiting online to get in somewhere. Does it sort of represent something about the zeitgeist and fatigue with micro trends that's now carrying over to culinary micro trends as well?
Absolutely. I think it's the exhaustion is real when it comes to following the new and noteworthy restaurants. Mm-hmm. And I think there's also, it's unproven. I think savvy diners, people who've lived in New York for some time, know that the first 6 months of a restaurant can be extremely shaky. And what you don't want is to go to a restaurant on week three and really be disappointed from the get-go if it's like you're seated 20 minutes late or they ignore you at the table. And I think like there's a little bit of that creeping in when we're looking at all these new restaurants. We're thinking about every single bad restaurant experience we had at brand new restaurants, and we're like just feeling that anxiety. And I think what we should be doing is both. I think we do need to support new restaurants. Obviously, it's important to go out and check out the new places and be a great guest. But we have had this wonderful ongoing dialogue with Michael McCarty from Michael's. You know, he's been running these restaurants in New York and LA since 1978. And I asked him straight up, like, how do you support a restaurant that's had some heritage that's there for? And he's like, just go a lot. And I think about that all the time. I think about like places, I'm just going to name some names. Like think about like French Louis in Brooklyn. I think about Thai Diner. Mm-hmm. I think about places in Koreatown, like Hanbat, Chodonggol. And I'm like, these are places that aren't being written about really that much. And these are places I just love going to because they're absolutely great restaurants that have 5, 7, 10 years on them. They're hurting some of these, maybe not those places that I mentioned, but places that are at like places that are at year one and year two that aren't going to get into Grub Street as much. They really need your support. So if you think back, I still use Swarm, which I fucking love. So I look back at my Swarm and I always look back a couple years. I'm like, where did I go over the past couple years? And then when I'm thinking about where I want to meet friends or just to have a drink or something with a, mm-hmm. with a ketchup, I'm like, I want to go to the places that I know that I'm going to get a great experience and maybe they need my support more than ever.
What do you think about this trend of not having physical space? I don't mean like a ghost kitchen, but a restaurant that doesn't have physical space but only exists as a pop-up. And I'm thinking of Shy's Burgers, for example.
Make Thai. Like,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, Haas was a great example of that pivot, right? Going from pop-up only to physical space. So what do I think? I think that knowing labor costs, knowing the cost of real estate in New York, I'm such a fan of a restaurant, of chefs who want to put themselves out there in a pop-up setting. Eliza,
I'm say something potentially controversial.
Yeah, please.
The pop-up is sort of the newsletter of restaurants.
I like it. So do you mean you subscribe for like a couple weeks and then you unsubscribe? Is that
no,
the cognate?
No, I just mean it's like, it's direct, but it's also, it's a little bit more free floating than the restaurant, which is a little bit like a website, a .com.
It's exciting.
Website.
I think it's, the newsletters excite me. When I get dirt, I'm just excited. And mm-hmm. I think when I see a pop-up, you know, Eliza talks a lot about the pop-ups around New York. She's a big fan of them. She supports them. I think she has a lot of empathy and just supports. And Redora in Brooklyn does a lot of pop-ups that mm-hmm. show incredible talent. My biggest issue with pop-ups is that literally it's so inconsistent if it's good or bad. And you mm-hmm. have to kind of go in with it's like a contract that this might not be the most polished cuisine. It certainly won't be on a service point be that exceptional, because how could you run a restaurant and make it exceptional on the service side after being open for 30 minutes? But on the flip side, it shows incredibly, I would say, exciting cuisines that maybe don't have brick and mortars. And you're literally putting money into the hands of somebody for the work they're doing. It's like such a direct payment when you're doing a pop-up. And it's like maybe helping them pay rent for that week. Mm-hmm. It might be helping them invest in a brick and mortar where they need to pay that $30,000 key money that they haven't been able to figure out. So I think it's like really when you're supporting pop-ups, it's not really about the food and the cost of a pop-up too. It could be a little higher than you're used to paying. If it's like a fixed menu, I would say like understand that you're in contract with that pop-up chef, that you're helping support them like a Patreon kind of model.
That makes complete sense. It's like you want the food, or maybe you want to read the newsletter, you want to listen to the episode of the podcast, but it's more of like the community. It's this like social, it's about the social fabric at that point,
yeah,
in a way that's more appealing than when you're eating at like, you know, X new big money restaurant backed by X millions of dollars to be, you know, in a hot spot.
Have you guys been to Bridges yet, either of you? Because I have not.
No, but that's exactly what I was thinking about as I was saying that.
I was like, what are you talking about?
I have not been, though. I did read, there was, I read, okay, speaking of a newsletter that I don't currently pay for, Emily Sundberg's Feed Me, there was, before The Fold, I do read it, but as I get stopped at the paywall, but she was quoting Eddie Wong in his new venture with Places, which is some app. Anyways, but he had this good line about like there's a difference between a hot neighborhood and a hot block, and everybody on the hot block is like an orange wine seeking resi vampire there to drink orange wine before dawn. But he was talking about Bridges.
He's one of our finest writers in the food space and food writing, and I love that Eddie has a really robust Substack now, and his podcast is a lot of fun. So true. I think you get these blocks that become absolutely inundated with the hype and the lines, and it doesn't define a neighborhood, and certainly it doesn't define that era, that time. It just is what's happening in the culture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think I lived in like Clinton Hill, Fort Greene. I lived in Clinton Hill, Fort Greene, well, around 2017, and a little bit of that was happening like on Fulton Street. But it comes in waves, obviously. And I think, like a good meal, the pacing of those openings depends on whether it's going to be a net positive or a net negative for the block.
So much choice. And you got those, you have that landlord, you know, charging you that rate every week and or every month. And those bills come very quickly. So that's why, back to my original point, look back at the restaurants you loved over the past 18 months. If you're a list maker, a Google Map maker, look back at the data that you've created around your restaurant going. It could be literally your photos. Just look at your photos and just remember the places that you liked 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Just go there, like support those, because those are the places that maybe were hot for a second, but then they may be struggling. And if you had a good experience the first time, chances are your experience the second time is going to be positive.
This is maybe like a, you know, recession indicator type of moment. But the way you're talking about this also makes me think of media and the idea of evergreen content, right? And the idea that you don't need to be dumping so much resources into creating the new thing every week. Like, you've got that great article from 3 months ago, 6 months ago, 5 years ago, that's sitting there that people would still be interested in, that people would reread even if they've already read it, because it's been so long.
Yeah.
And like, it's, I think that's something people forget, and that's hard to like, well, how do we make this fresh? How do we get it out there again? This idea of like evergreen restaurants as a, or like older restaurants as the foundation for series, for whether it's like, whether it's a Taste, whether it's a Grub Street, whether it's, you know, any of these Instagram reel creators. I feel like that is something that it's one of those ideas that isn't an original idea by any means, but it's like something that more people are going to arrive at in this moment of, especially of like, you know, tightening the purse strings, more food media about long time institutions.
Oh yeah. Great point, Francis. I think you definitely want to cover the evergreen. I like the comparison, because I think we surface some of our older stories, because we do write a lot of stories that are evergreen. And I think it's in this time of great news cycles, not just politically, but on the tech side, just so much news cycle content is being consumed that it's nice to surface a story. Even if the byline says 2019, it still has a lot of value to our readers. And we, in our Friday newsletter, which we put out as kind of a digest of the week in writing and some audio, we like to surface older stories from publications, because yes, there's lots of value there. It doesn't need to be the new shiny toy for these types of reporting. And I love the tie back to the idea that a restaurant doesn't have to be the shiny new toy. It can be an absolute, you know, just a classic place and really deliver.
So I just remembered this great data point from this newsletter I like, Push to Talk. This guy, Ryan Rigney, he writes about the video game industry, which I, you know, played a lot of video games when I was younger. I barely do anymore, but his newsletter is one of my favorites because he's so smart and like the stories he finds. So the title of this one, it's from a few months ago, from September actually, Are Old Games Killing New Games? And he has this graph here that in 2023, 61% of all playtime on video games was spent on games that had been released over 6 years previously.
Wow.
And in 2023, just 5 games, most of them released over a decade ago, together accounted for more playtime than every game released in 2022 and 2023 combined.
Wow. That's stunning. I mean, I don't know the game industry one bit, except for The Last of Us, which shouts, what a show. I want to play this game, but I think there's something to do with just when a story or a restaurant has some seasoning on it, has some time.
Cast iron pan.
Well said, Daisy. That's why this is a great podcast. Those lines, tying it together, a well-seasoned cast iron pan. For the record, I do use soap, but that's for another podcast.
Controversial.
Because
steel wool.
Yeah, steel wool is the way to go. I sometimes pull that out. But I just think like having a little bit of time, be it a video game, be it a restaurant, be it a great feature. I think that you're going to obviously find new audience too. Remember, like, old restaurants are new to somebody. New old stories are new to somebody. So they may have just found your publication. They may have just found that neighborhood and moved there. And like, let's try out some of the local places. So
yeah, I'm trying to do a better job with that. Actually, somebody said to me over the weekend about Froyo being a recession indicator. And I remembered we had a piece about that from last year called Froyomonium. And I was like, I think it's right. It's time to dust that off. But I'm curious whether you're seeing a bit of a Froyo revival right now.
I walked by Tasty Delight recently. There still is one on the Upper East Side. And I was like, I got to fucking go there. Yeah, I think Froyo is definitely going to be a recession indicator. I think I wish 16 Handles had survived. I still have a really, really, really soft spot in my heart for 16 Handles.
Well, I'm sure there are like 16 Handles t-shirts on Poshmark, vintage.
That's a great gift idea.
Vintage Y2K inspired.
$23.
But, you know, Daisy and Francis, do you guys, I feel like there's a little pressure that we put on ourselves when you post an old byline. You said dusting off as a joking, but there's almost like a pride thing, how we like only need to be doing new stuff all the time, which I think is a mistake. Because I think
I've never put pressure on myself in my life.
I appreciate that. I just think we internalize like, am I being lazy? Am I being less ambitious to like resurface old content, big air quotes there, using content and which I don't like to use.
No, I mean, you're right. I think though, like I saw a great quote from Tyler, the Creator recently. He was like, I'm still promoting the thing that I like, the album I published a year ago, and I'm going to keep promoting it for a year. Like, why would I put like years of work into that? Why would I stop? And maybe, you know, in an article, you're not necessarily putting in years of work, but you're still putting in that high scale. And I mean, I'm guilty of this too. Like, I will promote a thing for twice over a week and then I kind of move on and I forget to go back, but you kind of just forget it's there. But, or like in marketing, like at my last job, we always talked about like, you know, 90% of the people that you want, 99% of the people that you want to see this thing aren't going to see it the first time. 80% of them aren't going to see it the second time, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to alienate people by posting it 5-10 times, promoting it 20 times, right? Like, you're just actually going to reach a higher saturation of your potential audience.
Yeah,
that's exactly it. I mean, I was going through our survey last night for Blank, where we asked people, what's the best book you read last year? And one book that came up a lot, I did not say how often a book came up when I ran the results. I just said, this is every book mentioned. But there's a book called, I believe it's God of the Woods. Yeah, by Liz Moore. Came up a lot. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing it when it first came out and saying, I'd really like to read that. And it took seeing it like three times in the survey to be like, I'm definitely going to read that in the next couple months. And this is a conversation that I've had with publishers when they want to advertise in Dirt, which is, what are your expectations? Because we expect to be one of six mentions that cause somebody to convert. You know, do you need that to see them convert off our newsletter specifically to feel like this has been a success? Or do you have other ways of counting this exposure as, you know, fulfilling your KPIs? Because I don't want to make any guarantees around conversions, but I can guarantee if somebody sees it in Dirt and then they see somebody tweet about it later, that we will be a crucial node in that person eventually buying that book, because that's how I think and that's my relationship to books.
Yeah. Did you guys read The Most by Jessica Anthony?
Even know it.
I'm sorry, this is a tangent, because I totally agree that connecting the dots is part of the way we think about our partnerships as well. Like, we're not going to, it's not like CTA link track data and like, you know, conversion of sales. It's about working with a brand that you really like, a media brand, and that the audience is quality, right? It's brand safe and quality. But The Most is amazing. It's a novella. It's like 130 pages. It's the log line is basically 1957. Housewife, alcoholic husband, enters the pool and doesn't want to leave in her apartment complex. And
We did an interview with her.
Oh, cool. There you go. There you go.
I didn't say I never heard of it.
Flex.
Did I say I never heard of it? I don't know.
Flex.
I have heard of The Most, and we did cover it in the newsletter.
It's in paperback now. And like,
great cover. Putting a pool on the cover. I don't know if this is like the David Hockney effect, but my eye immediately goes to it if there's a swimming pool.
I read this, my wife read it, our friend read it, and there's eighth son in eighth grade read it in the weekend. We like passed it around. It's a really quick read. So great.
So I was going to say, Daisy, we're talking about all this evergreen content, et cetera. Like, one of the best examples of this is how much you've promoted Bad Waitress. That's like the Dirt story. And I feel like you guys post about it like every other month or something. And it's, and there's no reason not. I mean, I've only read it once, to be honest, but like every time I see it, I'm
read
like,
it again.
That was a really good
read
story.
Read it this afternoon.
What's yeah. the Bad Waitress author update? Is there anything happening? I love that piece so much.
What do you mean? Like,
what's she up to?
I feel like there's like
Becca's still a bad waitress.
No, sorry, Rebecca. I couldn't remember her name because we had emailed before. I mean, I feel like
when are you having her on your podcast?
Oh yeah, we talked about that.
You should have her come on to talk about the Anthony Bourdain biopic, which she also wrote about for us. She's the person whose opinion I would trust the most on that. Mm.
Say her last name just so I remember.
Shu.
S-C-H.
All right.
U-H.
That's for plug to her on the podcast, but also so I remember to reach back and talk about that incredible piece.
I think Bad Waitress, well, okay, it was always going to be worth talking about because it's well written, but it is only becoming more relevant over time.
Yeah.
You know, it's as relevant as it's ever been. So
One thing I really want to talk about before we get to the end here, Daisy, we were talking about this a little bit off mic before, but Clone was written about in Nieman Lab today. There was this
which play. I missed. I didn't. It was written about on the 8th. I only saw it this morning.
Oh my God. Five days ago.
If you're going to write me a Nieman, at least send me the link if you're not going to interview me.
But this bit about you identifying yourself as a founder and that people not necessarily liking that and people grading on that and people not recognizing themselves as small business
owners. I came up with the Instagram bio in 2 seconds for this thing, which was like your favorite founder's favorite bookmark. And some people had a very strong negative reaction to that. And I mean, my response to that criticism is a little bit facetious because it was not, there was a little snark in it. And I think, like, I don't care. You know, it's a blog. You have to have a little bit of snark in it.
Startup-y, techie.
Yeah, but I'm like, everyone who is charging for their Substack is a founder. Like, I tweeted, like, you don't have a newsletter, you have a small business on a rentier platform. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand why it's so hard for people to admit that. Like, you hung up a shingle, you're taking money from people, you have founded a business. And I know that your vision of founder is like Elizabeth Holmes and the worst people alive, but it's also the person that runs the coffee shop that you go to every day. And it's not that I think people should have more respect for the title. I just think people should be a little bit more honest about all the points of economic exchange that they're involved in their creative consumption and in their creative, like in the stuff they themselves create, especially if they're charging for it, because it doesn't serve anyone to pretend that you're not running a business. And in fact, you leave yourself incredibly vulnerable for manipulation by the platforms like Substack that you're working with.
It's almost like being alienated from your food to make it smiling. The metaphor is, you know, like if you eat at insert here fast food restaurant, like you should be aware of like the slaughterhouse conditions and supply chain and like how fucked up that can be. But to take it back to like the small business media thing, it's like, you know, if you're on Substack and that's how you're running your business, like you should be aware of the value relationships and that like, you know, Substack makes money by basically providing you these tools for free. You get this, you know, subscription fee if you start doing that. Andreessen Horowitz is making money on them. Andreessen Horowitz, like, blah, blah, blah. The whole chain and supply chain of, like, how these tools come to you and like, how money is exchanged, how data is exchanged. Like, it's, I don't know, it's important to, like, de-alienate yourself from that. And you can participate in it, but you should think about it.
I got to say something. All love to the people I know that work at New York Magazine. The second New York Mag joined Substack became a headline, I was like, you fucked up. You guys fucked up so bad because that headline does everything for Substack and nothing for you.
Yeah.
And in fact, Corey...
He left the company after 5 days. And
I was like, I mean,
what was the deal there? What was the story there?
What is
What
is Adam Moss thinking right now? Like, Adam Moss, like, made that magazine, like, truly, like, a vessel that you want to put on your coffee table.
They fucked up so bad.
New editor, of course, David, same tradition. So why the fuck would you go into a platform that does everything against aesthetics that you cared so deeply about? I mean, I think they were just like trolling a little bit, frankly. I subscribed for the first day or two and then I just unsubscribed because I was like, dinner party is a cool thing. I get it once in a while.
But do you get dinner party off? You get it off their regular distribution.
Yeah, I get dinner party. I like dinner.
And it was the same content?
I mean, I couldn't even, I think it was maybe cut down a little bit, but I think that they're, and you know, I got love for Substack folks. Like I like Austin a lot, Tedesco, and I think they're trying things out, but I don't know why it's not the perfect fit for New York Mag. And it felt exactly right. Well said. Substack got everything out of that and New York Mag got shit. So
I would be extremely upset if a headline like that was written about my company. And I've done a lot to never put myself in that position.
Yeah, they're just playing, they're testing stuff.
Yeah, but no company should ever benefit from your long decades of brand and reputation building more than you do.
Well, what this is, though,
every step that you take.
It's a bet. I mean, they're hoping that they're trading that association for user growth, right? And like, to me, what I see Substack as is it's Patreon plus Twitter plus basically a startup accelerator for small media businesses. Mm-hmm. With a newsletter feature attached. It's New York Magazine, I think, treating it as Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah. And they want to be first mover too. Remember, New York Mag is so brilliant at that. They're first movers in so many areas of media. And they're a first mover on moving on to Substack as an established legacy media brand, actually caring about Substack. I haven't seen too many other. I've seen brands go on, but I haven't seen publications do it. So I think they wanted to be a first mover. That's probably more important than having Substack steal the headlines.
Well, everyone's now seen that headline and they're not going to do it. So first mover, last mover. Hammering this hard, but I really think like brand and reputation is everything. Never, ever, ever give it up to somebody who's been around so much shorter than you have.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially New York Mag is such a good brand.
Yeah. It was an interesting experience.
It's a big halo for Substack. And in Substack, I give them credit as founders for what they've built, but they do not deserve that halo from the mainstream publishing industry.
Mm-hmm. Rentier. It's the rentier newspaper. We should.
All software is rentier, but like,
that's true.
A lot of times it has like utility as well.
Let's wrap it up on a positive note.
Yeah.
Fine.
Matt, what's one thing?
Rose and Thorn. No, I'm just kidding.
No. What's the most memorable thing that you've eaten so far this year? And one thing or place that you're excited to eat?
I was in Vancouver and I had a buri sushi, which is like the square blowtorch sushi. So it's like slightly different. Mm-hmm. It's like you get it sometimes in omakases, but Vancouver has this amazing history with this style of sushi. And I just think it really hits me in the right spot. I love that style of sushi. I had it a couple places in Vancouver. I also went to Stissing House this weekend. They're just
the one upstate, right?
Yeah,
that's
it's in Pine Plains. Mm-hmm. It's really a great restaurant. They're in year three. I just think that they're doing such amazing work, not just in culinary, but style of service and just like a really, really cool place to visit. So Stissing House was great.
Seasoned, but not too seasoned.
Not too seasoned. I like also coming back.
Three.
What was the second question?
A place that you hope to eat soon, or like a thing that you hope to eat soon. Maybe it's what you're making for lunch. I don't know.
Oh no, what do I want to eat? I mean, I think I'm going to Portland this weekend.
Which one?
Sorry, good call. It's exactly the right follow up question. The Oregon.
Back for 8 years, but I went to college there.
Yeah, what a wonderful city. I haven't been in about a year, and I love going there for food and. I just think my friend Jordan Michaelman writes for Taste is writing a novel about Portland. I read his manuscript, is fucking so good. And I just want to go to some old school places, and Jordan's going to take me to a few. I'm cool with some of the newer places, but I want some like 90s to early 2000s Portland.
You got to visit M. Seeley Katz in the oldest niche perfume house in Portland while you're there.
See
if they can hook you up with a new signature scent.
Thank you for Daisy. That's a great recommendation. M. Seeley Katz going in.
I have one recommendation for
Please.
You. Maybe it's a little too new. I think it's about 12 years or more by now. One of my favorite places. I know you're not a drinker anymore, but you don't need to be a drinker to go here. It's called Stammtisch, German restaurant. It's the best. My father's from Bavaria. I went there with him. He said the best German food he's had outside of Germany and better than most in Germany. I haven't been there for 8 years, but I know they're still
Love
kicking.
That.
And it was, you know, for like a pretzel or a Schweinshaxen or any classic German food that, you know, you could find at whatever like 50-year-old tourist trap German restaurant, but actually good.
Such a great rec, Francis. Mm-hmm. My grandmother was born in Munich.
Oh, there you go.
I love that food so much. And I I just think Portland has many dimensions. Obviously, you live there. And I just think that that pre-Portlandia Portland is what I'm trying to get a little sense of, because there's such a cool history of Portland in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And that I want that's like one of my big goals with this trip.
Portlandia is so nostalgic. We'll stop and say here. Portlandia is so nostalgic for me now because I moved there for college a year after it started and I left a year before it ended. So like I rewatched a few episodes recently and it's been long enough where I was like, wow, this was my
that's like real documentary. Portland to you. It's like Greenpoint depicted in Girls doesn't exist anymore.
All right, we should wrap it up. Was this Taste or was it Tasteland? It was both. You got a double dose of Taste today.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you for coming on, Matt.
Thank you,
Francis and Daisy. Thank you so much for inviting me. I love your show. Thank you. So cool. Appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure. All right.
See you next week.